As the Israeli Defense Force continues on its path of destruction and violence throughout Palestinian communities in an attempt to crush the Palestinian uprising against the Israeli occupation, the repression and brutality which Palestinian activists, communities, and people experience on a day-to-day basis becomes clear with the lockdown or curfews which have been imposed on Palestinian cities like Nablus. We spoke to Sam Bahar, a Palestinian writer, father, and businessman living under the Israeli occupation, while under Israeli curfew and lockdown. Sam looks at the context of the Israeli occupation, the realities facing Palestinians as the school year begins, and the economic apartheid which the occupation has created, leaving much of Palestinian society in poverty.
Today we had a very creative measure of occupation. After we sent our children to school this morning, school has been in session here for 4 days. During the last 4 days, we've been allowed to leave our homes between 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Today we thought that was no different, that we would be allowed to have a lifting of the curfew during the day. We sent our children to school and everybody went to work and doing their business. About 9:30, tanks and jeeps came into town and announced on loudspeakers that the city is under full military curfew. No one should leave there wherever they are. This was frantic because every parent had their children not at home in schools. We basically turned on Israeli radio, and they formally announced that Ramallah is totally under curfew until 1 o'clock, and that the Israeli military would open the curfew, lift the curfew from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m., enough time for people to leave work, get their children, and go home. And that's where we are right now. I'm sitting home under full military curfew, waiting to see what's going to happen tomorrow morning.
You mentioned that school has been back in session. People are at work. So could you speak about those two things specifically, the educational system and the economics within Palestinian society? How are they affected by curfew?
Sure. Regarding school, just to put it into context, we've lived the summer months under continuous Israeli occupation and military curfew and closure, which means that my city, El Bire and Ramallah, are completely closed from the outside world unless you come through an Israeli checkpoint. Those checkpoints, some days, if we're lucky, are open a few hours a day. This has been throughout the summer. And the curfews usually are 3 to 4 days, continuous 24 hours, and they would lift the curfew for 4 to 6 hours every third or fourth day for people to buy supplies. We were very anxious to see how the Israeli government was going to deal with such measures, given that the school year was going to start on this past Saturday. And as expected, at least from my point of view, the entire world was also, the international community was watching to see what would happen, because the stakes became tenfold, given that the entire education system was basically going to be on the verge of collapse if that starting day of school would have been under closure. There was a lifting of the curfew on Saturday. We found this out about 6 a.m. Saturday morning through loudspeakers in our city from Israeli jeeps, that we would be allowed to take our children to school. This was a very serious moment for parents because they had to decide to take their children to school knowing that there was very heavy instability in the entire issue. For the last 4 days, it's been a routine, if I can call it that, that the it was going to be open. And as I said, we were surprised today that it wasn't. The entire education system in preparing for this school year has had one major catastrophe after another. Some of the school buildings, the physical facilities that children were supposed to go back to, have been destroyed over the summer. So this caused the Ministry of Education here to reallocate some children, I'm talking about a few hundred children, to different schools. Schools that are already overcrowded, so they didn't have enough chairs or tables or teachers to deal with the rearrangement of the student body. In addition to that, today I heard as well that the Bir Zeit University, which is the university closest to Ramallah, it's a large metropolitan-style university, for the first time in a very long time, had Israeli soldiers enter the school ground, the university grounds. Also, above and beyond the just the physical damage that is being done, the supplies of the school, for example, the textbooks that my third grade 8-year-old was supposed to receive, were delayed in being arriving at school, so they did not get their textbooks the first day of school. These are the kind of structural damage that's being done in the education system, and that's not even to touch on the mental and emotional and physical damage being done to the students or the parents themselves. I can talk about the economics a little bit.
Go ahead.
I'm a business person. I'm building a large retail development project in Ramallah. It's a $10 million publicly traded company. We're supposed to build this plaza or mini mall. We started in 1999. It was supposed to be a 2-year project before it would open. I'm going into my third year now, trying to struggle to finish the project due to the closures and curfews and so forth. After 2 years of living under this kind of situation of Israeli aggression and reoccupation of Palestinian cities, basically, I can confidently say that 90-95% of the business feasibilities of most companies here have been totally lost. Remaining here and remaining engaged in the business sector and the economic sector basically is due to our national commitment that we have and not to a business or investment commitment that we started with. Life has come to a complete standstill. We are at the call of the Israeli soldier that's in the street. If he allows us to go to work, we go to work. If he doesn't, we don't. And unfortunately, the international community, on top of the list of the United States, is watching this happen. At the same time, calling for the Palestinians to make reform in their government and their governance and so forth. It's almost ridiculing the entire situation that you're asking me to reform my government while you allow me to be put under curfew in my home for days at a time.
Can you speak about how curfew affects families? You have children of your own. Can you speak about what they go through emotionally and physically being under curfew?
Well, we had about a month ago, for example, give a personal example, we had our home entered by around 17, 16 Israeli soldiers who were doing house-to-house searches. This is scary for adults, let alone for children. We've been searched twice so far. One of them was very early in the morning. We were all sleeping, and we receive a doorbell saying that this is the Israeli army. They wanted someone to come down to meet them. So I went down to meet them, and as you know, many people have gone down to meet the Israeli soldier at the door only to find that the Israelis had already rigged explosives on the front door and exploded the front door off of the hinges. So this was a very scary flight down the stairs. I greeted the Israeli soldier and asked him what he would like. He told me who's upstairs. I explained to him my children, my father, my parent. He told me to have everyone come out of the house. He said, "Do you understand Hebrew?" I said, "No." He said, "Do you understand English?" I said, "Yes." I said, "Please." He said, "If anyone remains in the house, we'll kill them." So I went upstairs, brought my family down, and after he confirmed that there was no one left upstairs, he sent in these 15, 16, 17 soldiers, and they basically went through all of our personal belongings. This is one example of what's happened in every single neighborhood in the West Bank over the last 5 or 6 months. We live daily and nightly with Israeli tanks, and Israeli tanks are much larger than what Hollywood portrays them to be. These are 60-ton tanks that go through streets that were not made for two cars to pass at the same time, and we hear them rumble through our neighborhood every single night. As you're aware, we've been under military curfew every night. Sometimes they lift the curfew, as I said, but that's only during the daytime. Every single night we've been under curfew since the last week of March. This is the way we've been living, and it's horrifying for the children to wake up to this. I see long-term ramifications. My children refuse to sleep. I have an 8-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old daughter who refuse to stay in any room of the house alone. My wife or myself sleep with them every single night because they are too scared to sleep alone. My 2-year-old daughter, her first set of vocabulary was in Arabic, of course, tank, jeep, curfew, airplane. This is what the next generation of Palestinians is witnessing. I would only ask the world, what do they expect the Palestinian response to be in 1 year or 5 years or 10 years? If the occupation continues, I fear that the resistance to the occupation will continue. If our Israeli neighbors feel that one day the Palestinians are going to wake up and throw chocolate bars at the soldiers, it's not going to happen. Every occupation in the world is resisted, and this one is no different. So I would appeal to my Israeli neighbors to end the occupation tonight, if not tomorrow morning, and let's get back on a road to peaceful coexistence, which after the last 2 years is going to take much, much longer than may have prior to that.
Can you speak about the political justification for curfews? You spoke of IDF, Israeli Defense Force, raids onto your home personally and homes within various communities. So can you speak about the political justification that the Israeli Defense Force puts forth?
There's absolutely, in my point of view, no political justification for curfews. Curfews, it sounds like a nonviolent word. It's full of violence. The word curfew in international law is called collective punishment. It means that because of an act of one person or a group of people, that you punish an entire society. If a Palestinian bomber creates an act of violence within Israel, one that I stand against personally, there is no justification whatsoever that every single citizen of my city, Ramallah and El Bire, would need to be put under military curfew. By implementing that violent act of putting an entire community under curfew, the only thing the Israelis are achieving is allowing every single Palestinian household to reach the level of frustration and despair. And that will only create additional people that are willing to carry out acts of violence against them. There is no justification whatsoever for collective punishment. No justification for locking down an entire population of 1 million people in the West Bank under the pretext that they're trying to reduce the acts of violence. Once you create that level of despair that I'm seeing in my community, then it becomes almost a mindset that you cannot release the curfew. You cannot let them live a normal life because you know that the reaction will be that more people are willing to do violence. This conflict definitely needs a third party. It needs the United Nations or a United States in a neutral fashion, if that can be done, to enter and impose an end to occupation. The entire international community took a stance against apartheid. They took a stance against Iraq, who invaded Kuwait. It's time, it's past time, for the international community of the United States to take an act against occupation and not to pay lip service to it.
Here in Montreal, we're getting ready for a visit from Benjamin Netanyahu, who will be here on Monday, September 9th. People are saying he's not welcome here. So can you speak about what Benjamin Netanyahu, people like Ariel Sharon, represent to Palestinian life?
Benjamin Netanyahu has the infamous credit of being the person who actually began the destruction of the Oslo process. If you recall, after a Jewish Israeli citizen extremist killed the Israeli Prime Minister Rabin, the government elected Benjamin Netanyahu, who was very clear in his political mind to say that he is against the Oslo process. And his first act as Prime Minister was to build a settlement south of Jerusalem in an area called Jebel Abu Ghneim. This is a mountain on the south of Jerusalem between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. And he confiscated this Palestinian land and began to build a settlement. He also took a second step of digging under the Dome of the Rock, which created a reaction to from the Palestinians. And he was the first prime minister after the Oslo process to send his Apache helicopters in the air and to fire upon Palestinians. This mindset of reoccupation, this started with Benjamin Netanyahu. He proudly, I would imagine, takes credit for the destruction of Oslo. And I would also say that he should not so proudly take credit for part of the reasons why Israeli citizens are being killed in the street, unrightfully so. Benjamin Netanyahu carries part of that responsibility for destroying the process that had a chance one time in history to create reconciliation between two peoples. He destroyed that process.
You're sitting under curfew right now. What can you possibly do during the day when you're not allowed to leave your home? The Israeli Defense Force has made that impossible.
First and foremost, we try to reduce the negative effect of this reoccupation and curfew upon our children. I spend a lot of time playing with my girls. I spend a lot of time playing school with them because I know that they're not getting the education that they deserve as any other child in the world deserves. So we play school in hopes to be able to fill part of the gap that they're facing. Personally, I write a lot as well. I try to explain to the Western audience mostly of what it means for an entire population of 1 million people to be put under curfew, or in the case of the Gaza Strip, for example, to be completely enclosed, not being able to leave the Gaza Strip, what that means to employment, what that means to education, what that means to the healthcare system, and what that means for the prospects of a future political settlement. So first and foremost, we're trying to take care of our family, to be safe. And this is very practical. When a tank goes in front of my house, rumbling down the road, I need to make sure that my children aren't at the windows. If I had to face this 1 or 2 days, I think I can manage with it. We've been facing it now straight since March, and it's basically putting every single Palestinian in a very nervous condition that will not last for long. I cannot see us living like this for much longer. We try as much as possible to maintain some kind of continuity in our businesses by working out of our homes. For example, in the project that I'm building, I paid an extra expense to have people sleep in the project to be able to work. I allowed my employees to take their computers home with them so they can work. It cannot suffice to say that this cannot be an alternative to a real work environment and a real education system. But the Palestinian people are not going to kneel down and or pack their bags and leave. We have nowhere to go. I mean, this is our home. So we will do the best with all the resources, with all the energy that we have, until the occupation comes to a crumbling end.
So one final question. How do you feel that the international community can help support Palestinians living under curfew and ultimately the fight against the Israeli occupation?
I think that two levels need to be worked on. One level is the official diplomatic government-to-government level. I think that many countries around the world have a lot of leverage with Israel that is not being used to convince Israel that it is in their benefit to end the occupation. And I think that governments could play a more stronger role. Specifically, the United States has many, many different tools at its disposal, whether it's military aid, financial aid, scientific and research development cooperation. Across the board, there's many, many different tools from a government level that can be taken. But maybe more importantly, after I've seen so many years of non-governmental proactiveness in this area, I think the time has come for civil society to take a more active role in being able to address, number one, Israeli civil society, number two, the civil society within their own communities, to say that, for example, Canadian business interests in the Middle East require political and economic stability. What's stopping that stability from happening is the continuation of occupation. So I think that from a civil society, from an average citizen's point of view, it's time that people become more involved in convincing their elected leaders that something needs to be done before another catastrophe happens in the world in this conflict, which has been going on for too long. With all of the sensitive hotspots in the world, the one issue that could have the potential to relax the international chaos that's happening is the resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So Canadians working to end this conflict would not only be working to help Palestinians and Israelis, but also would be contributing to softening this rhetoric of war that we're hearing every single day. And it's in no one's benefit for that to happen. So I urge just average citizens and civil society organizations and leaders, and religious leaders as well, to step forward and take the lead in ending the occupation.
Okay, thank you for joining us today.
Very much, thank you.
That was an interview with Sam Bahar, a Palestinian writer, father, and businessman living under the Israeli occupation. If you're interested in receiving articles and reports written by Sam Bahar, email sbahour@palnet.com. For more information and analysis about the Palestinian uprising against the Israeli occupation, visit www.zmag.org. For more information about how to plug in and get involved in assisting on the ground in Palestine, check out the International Solidarity Movement at www.palsolidarity.org. This interview was produced by Stefan Christoph for CKUT Radio in Montreal.